Before we start the show, let's talk about Sundays for Dogs at Sundays Food for Dogs. Website is sundaysfordogs.com. And Sundays for Dogs is dog food, yeah. And your dog deserves healthy, real food, not kibble. Sundays is real food for dogs, formulated by a vet with only the highest quality fresh meat, veggies, fruit, and superfoods, then air-dried to perfection. Made in the USA at a USDA human food facility. So that's really good. And if you love your dog, you're going to want to feed your dog the best food, and this food is great. You get hassle-free money-back guarantee. Tastes like a treat, but it's really well-balanced. If your dog's picky, this might help out. It's made from real, raw, whole food ingredients, air-dried for super nutrition, taste, and convenience. And it's all natural and easy to serve and easy for your dog to eat. And when they eat well, they poop better, too. So nice, smooth stool, increased excitement about eating, more energy, improved weight, and a softer coat. Now, you could take a quick quiz to find out if this is the right plan for your pup by going sundaysfordogs.com. And if you want to make a purchase, use promo code PODFIX, promo code PODFIX, and you get 35% off your order.
Begin PODFIX network transmission in 3, 2, 1.
Fly fishing in a stream, getting those ankles wet, or deep in the ocean casting nets. Fish nerds. Fish nerds. Fish nerds. It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Fish Nerds, the show about fish, fishing, and eating fish. I'm Clay Groves, Chief Executive Fish Nerd, Licensed Fishing Guide, and your best friend. I know our schedule for releasing podcasts has been uneasy lately. That's because my schedule in real life is uneasy lately, but I'm doing what I can. Still love making the podcast for you, so I appreciate you sticking around and getting through it. Luckily, we've got Doc Martin. Doc Martin is our science correspondent. She is at Emporia State University, been with the podcast for 10 years, and she loves talking about fish with us, and we're so lucky. So in the last episode, we talked about why sharks matter with Dr. Schiffman. And now we're doing another shark episode because Doc Martin, of course, the nerd she is, she likes to get into it also. And so she met shark researcher and paleontologist Phil Starnes. And she's going to interview Phil Starnes all about sharks. And there's a special surprise at the end of this interview. And that's it. We're going to jump right into the show. Here is Phil Starnes and Doc Martin.
Hey, everybody. Doc Martin here. I'm really excited to bring you our guest today. We have a shark researcher here who's going to talk about what he does and some of the specifics of some of his recent shark research. And then we have a special guest at the very end who will ask some cutting edge questions, I'm sure. And so welcome, Phil, shark researcher. Thanks for joining us on the Fish Nerds.
Yes, thank you so much for having me here. And yeah, happy to talk about sharks for the next 40 minutes, hour or so. This should be a lot of fun.
Well, I hope so. Your research is very interesting. But before we jump in there, why don't you give us a little bit of a background on just generally where are you at in your career and what is your specialty?
Yeah. So right now I'm finishing up. Yeah, because we finally survived the third year. I'm finishing up my third year in the PhD program for the Department of Evolution, Ecology, and Organismal Biology here at the lovely University of California, Riverside. So for those who don't know where that's about 45, 50 miles east of Los Angeles, or a little inland, but it is the nice Southern California area. Yeah, so just finished up my third year. Previously, I'd done my master's degree, which took 2 years. So I've been at the graduate level for the past 5 years, and that's where I've exclusively focused on studying sharks, why sharks look the way they do, how sharks swim, how does this relate to their ecology and lifestyle. And basically what I've had the joy of doing is I've gotten to know all the shark species, because to understand body form patterns, their evolution, you have to look at every single species. And sometimes you have to go back in the past to see how things changed over the last couple hundred million years, because the great thing about sharks is they've been around for 400 plus million years. So there's a lot of evolutionary history to dig through. And then the other tricky part is sometimes you only got teeth to work with, but sometimes you get those rare preserved skeletons, which are great to look at, and they'll give you some insight. So It's been a joy because I've loved sharks since I was 5 years old after watching Jaws for the first time. And I actually just watched it not too long ago, ironically, because I watch it a couple of times a year, especially in the summertime. So yeah, here now finishing up my third year of the PhD program, and hopefully we'll be wrapping up in the next year or two and moving on to even bigger and better things.
Awesome. You did mention you study body form. Can you just explain for our listeners what that is exactly?
Yeah. So basically it's just, there are different regions of the body you can look at. So you got the head, you got the tail, you got the iconic tail fin, you got the dorsal fin, which is up on top. They'll break through the water. Then you got the two fins on the side, which are called the pectoral fins. And then you got two smaller fins that are in between the pectoral fins and the tail. And those are called the pelvic fins. So basically what I do is, in certain projects, I look at the whole shark and nothing but the shark. So basically the overall shape of the shark. So it's pure morphology. And then other times I will just focus on one aspect of the shark's body. So whether it just be the tail fin, because are they differently shaped among all the shark species? Or I'll just look at the pectoral fin, is like, how are those differently shaped and how do those relate to their ecology and lifestyle? So basically take a picture of a shark and you look at it, you can see, you know, is it a deeper bodied shark? Is it a more slender, narrow shark? You know, I can tell people, it's like, all right, great example, or just focusing on the head. Hammerheads have the unique cephalofoil that looks like a hammer, and all other shark species don't have that hammer. So I ask questions, well, why does it look the way it does? So you'll see these patterns all throughout the sharks, and it's just cool to see how those things have changed and why they look the way they do. Because is it because of their lifestyle, or is it just something happened way back when? It's just a leftover and that's how it is today. So yeah, basically look at the whole shark and nothing but the shark, and why does it look that way? That's the questions I wonder.
And so when you're measuring those, so you take a photo and you do some morphological measurements, I'm going to assume based on, I don't do this very often, but like comparative morphometrics where you're just the distance from, you know, this fin to this fin as the function of a distance from another thing. And you kind of do ratios and mm-hmm. stuff like that. Is that what you do?
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, you're hitting the nail on the head. So it does vary. So those are what we call like our standard morphometrics measurements. Mm-hmm. So yep, I've done that plenty of times. I just did that with one of my recent projects. It's fun. Most of the time it is with dead sharks, because, or I should preserve specimens, because sometimes it is rather difficult to catch a live shark and bring it up on a boat and take all those measurements with a tape measure, not get bit, which can happen to some unlucky researchers. So what I will do is I will go to museum collections and I will pull out preserved shark specimens that may have been caught like back in the 50s, and they've been preserved in this lovely ethanol for a long time, and they smell great once you pull them out. So you'll take a tape measure and you'll, you know, measure the length of the fin, and then you'll take a picture of it with a ruler in the picture, and then you can go back later on and use the fancy program called ImageJ, and you have the scale bar so you can scale it, and then you just trace the outline of the fin, and it'll tell you the area of the fin, which is great because obviously, you know, if you're doing the area of a square, you know, it's length times width, and that gives you the area. But when you got an irregularly shaped thing like a fin, you can't just do a standard, you know, length times width. So you trace it, and then the program can actually calculate the area for you. And then going on, yes, ratios. So the critical component that I've been looking at is called aspect ratio, which is what most of my dissertation research has started to focus on with the pectoral fins. But yeah, aspect ratio mm-hmm. is just the relationship between the length of the fin and the area of the fin. So when you think about like planes, I guess that's the best way, the best example is that like long, narrow plane wings tend to have, those are what we call high aspect ratio pectoral fins, wings. And those are good for gliding long distances, very fuel efficient. And then you think about a fighter.
Sharks have long, narrow fins?
Yeah, yes, yeah. So we do see that with the truly iconic oceanic species, like a blue shark, one of the most common pelagic species you see out there. So a very long, narrow fin, which is just exciting. And then the other one, which I would argue is probably the most deadly, the deadliest shark in the world, which is the oceanic white tip. Because if you run into it, things don't tend to fare too well. Unfortunately, the survivors of the USS Indianapolis found out the hard way back. Back when. So yeah, long narrow fin there as well. But then you got other shark species, dogfish sharks, cat sharks. It's a very like short rounded fin. So it's like, oh, very low aspect ratio, which was, I was going to get to exactly next. So yeah, like a fighter aircraft, in case anyone's seen the new Top Gun recently, which has been in theaters, like our fighter aircraft tend to have like low aspect ratio wings. So they're very good for maneuverability. They can turn on a dime. And that's what we think the sharks use them for, but they're not very fuel efficient. It's like not good for long distances. It's like, okay, you can do a lot of quick things. And then if it's a plane, you're going to burn fuel and have to go back, you know, pretty quick. If it's a shark, you can turn a lot, move a lot. It's not very fuel efficient. You might have to rest on the bottom, which I'll discuss later with the ecology. So yeah, there's your standard morphometrics. It's just, it's length measurements and pictures. And then the other thing that I've utilized, it's a fancy tool, which has been going on for a little bit. I think its inception was back in the 80s. It's called geometric morphometrics. So what you do is, again, you take pictures of a lovely shark in this case, and you would plot, use a computer program. You're going to plot these little dots on the fin or whatever shape you're looking at, and use homologous points. So it's like points that are present on every single specimen or sample in your study. So in this case, if you got like a tail fin, there might be four iconic points on it, like the upper and lower origins of the tail fin, and then the two tips, the two apexes of the fin. And then you can put even more dots on there called what we call them semi-landmarks, and they'll actually trace the curve. So what this program will do is it will eliminate size, position, and orientation. And it will just purely look at the shape of the object. So it's like, it's the most quantitative assessment of the shape. So instead of just like a standard linear measurement or just area measurement, it's telling you what the actual shape looks like compared to each other. So it's very useful if you're trying to compare the shapes of any objects to each other or sharks in general. So it's fun. And it gives you a lot of cool quantitative data that can give you insights on many different things, including sharks.
And you did mention earlier, so you take pictures of preserved specimens or maybe of live sharks, if that's a possibility.
Yep.
But you did mention like stuff that's been gone for a long time and you only have teeth measurements. How does that play into comparing more recent specimens?
Yeah, that is one of the greatest hurdles we face with trying to understand shark evolution. So, you know, it's great for the shark paleontologists and just the shark community in general, because we have arguably the most abundant fossil vertebrate in the entire fossil record. So because the teeth are just shed constantly throughout the lifetime of the shark, so those will get buried in the sediment, and it's like, oh, we found another tooth. And then it's a lot of fun once you have to compare teeth to each other and figure out, okay, is this a new species or not? So you have a bunch of teeth. So when it comes to trying to understand the body form, that's where it gets tricky, because you can make the inferences that this is probably a similar looking species based on the tooth, because if they share a similar tooth pattern, we would assume that it's a close relative and we would think the body shape should be the same. But yeah, determining what it actually looks like, sometimes that is very, it could be wishful thinking. You make a lot of assumptions, as I think some people have found out, including myself. So the what I call the jackpot, or just like the great, you know, treasures, if you get those preserved outlines with the teeth. So it's like, you know, everything. It's like, okay, it's this tooth. So say you had the tooth back in a museum collection a long time ago. And it's like, all right, we know it's a species. And then 50, 60 years later, you go out to a dig or to a site and you find a preserved specimen with the teeth, and you pull off the teeth and you say, oh my God, it's this tooth. And you can go back and be like, all right, so now we know any shark that has this tooth would probably look like this, because we have that preserved outline. So when it comes to predicting what a shark looks like just based off its teeth, we just compare it to the modern day sharks and say, okay, it has a tooth shape similar to that, so we would expect it to probably look like that generalized body shape, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then my question is, I guess, if you have the teeth, and there's lots of different teeth, lots of different species there, have you ever have found the teeth and thought, oh, this must look like present day shark A, and then you find the preserved body outline and say, oops, oh no, we made a mistake? Has that ever happened?
Not yet to me. I mean, yeah, I haven't had that happen just yet, but I'm sure it has happened to others that are just like, that's weird. So, because there are times, and this is another thing, is the concept of convergent evolution, because that you might have, they'll arrive to the same body shape, you know.
And that's what convergent evolution really is starting off from different places and coming to the same point.
So we'll get, you know, we'll start at two totally different areas, but yeah, we'll converge to the same final endpoint. You know, I mean, the most iconic thing is, you know, the marine mammals, you know, like dolphins and whales look just like, you know, sharks in a way, but the same body shape. Now, the only thing is dolphins and whales have a fluke, which goes up and down, whereas sharks have a caudal fin that goes from side to side. Unfortunately, the mammals just could not rewire their neuromotor patterns to go back to side-to-side swimming. So, as you know, you think about how we walk, you know, moving along. So they just kept with that pattern going up and down. They still have all the same tail and fin shapes as sharks, which is just crazy. So, yeah, convergent evolution, that's that is an interesting thing, because you got to think, you know, with teeth, that's like the shark, that is everything to the shark, because they devote so much energy to producing teeth throughout their life. And obviously, you'd want to have teeth that are good for capturing your prey. So are you going after a soft body fish, or are you going to be a crushing specialist, you know, a durophagous eater? So we do see the convergent evolution in teeth. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that the body's going to do the same thing. So you bring up a good point. It's like, oh, yeah, the teeth might look the same as another species, but we don't know if the body looks the same. So again, it's a lot of inferences. You take a lot of assumptions, but sometimes once you get that preserved specimen and you find out, oh, yes, I was right. It's a bit of a, yeah, you throw the confetti in the air, celebrations. Like it all worked out well. I feel like I'm a genius and whatnot. So it's, yeah, it could be speculative, but it when you get the right answer, it's very rewarding.
And so of extant sharks, the ones that are still alive and you can get their teeth fairly easily, when do you really start to have trouble telling the difference between individuals? Like there's lots of different species of hammerheads. Do they all have really similar teeth? And it's really hard to tell, but you can definitely tell between, like, you know, a dogfish and a hammerhead, or where does that differentiation lie?
Yeah. So there's, yeah, it's, I remember the first time I tried doing this, and my former advisor, Dr. Ken Shimada, he watched me try to do it, like organize the teeth based on similar species. And he saw me, you know, make the piles on a piece of paper, and he left me to it for like an hour, and then he came back. He's like, oh yeah, I see you were having a fun time doing that. I was like, oh yeah. So, the first time you do it, it's a bit daunting. Yeah. So the good thing we do, for the most part, we see within like each lineage of sharks, the tooth pattern tends to be conserved. So it's like cat sharks will have similar teeth to cat sharks, you know, the laminiform sharks, the iconic one that has, white sharks, mako sharks. For the most part, you do see some similar patterns, but yeah, the laminiform sharks, which if we talk about them more today, yeah, they're a very oddball group, because, you know, you got the big white shark, which has large serrated teeth, but then you got other sharks in that same lineage, like the thresher sharks, that have very small, minute teeth, because they do this, you know, they use their tail to stun their prey. And then the prey will be stunned, and they'll just eat the little prey, you know, these little schooling fish, whereas a white shark's going to take down possibly a marine mammal, so it's going to have big, large serrated teeth. So, yeah, one of the shortcomings that we have, and what a lot of shark paleontologists have the issue with, there's a recent paper that suggested that we need more data on the extant sharks, because surprisingly, there has not been a lot of work on extant shark teeth. Like there is, you know, in the most recent book, Sharks of the World, they do have pictures of the teeth from like each shark jaw set, which is good. So it's very helpful. But you do see, yeah, the teeth can look very similar. So getting down to the species level, it can be very difficult to differentiate who's from who. So maybe at the genre level, you can be like, okay, it belongs to the Scleorhinus genus, or it belongs to the Lamina genus, or something like that. But getting to the actual species, that's where it can get pretty tricky. So yeah, you do run into that issue. And I'll go with the paper as well. We need more people to work on extant shark teeth if possible. I know it may not be the most exciting thing, but if, you know, people can start really digging into that and get data on that. And then the other thing I should bring up is, like with us, so obviously we have our baby teeth, and then the large adult teeth will come in. So we just get one replacement set, and generally they're just, you know, bigger teeth, stronger, and they'll be in our jaws, hopefully, unless you have an unfortunate accident and you should get a tooth chipped or lose one in a, you know, bad way, which I hope doesn't happen to anybody, or you just don't take care of your teeth. But sharks don't have to worry about that. They just constantly shed them. Again, take the white shark, for example. We're trying to look into this great concept of, do the teeth change throughout the life of the shark? Do they change in shape? So you have tooth shape change throughout the life of the shark as well. So you have that issue as well. As it gets older, do they get bigger? Do they get wider compared to when they were a juvenile? So that's another issue, because you can look at the teeth and be like, oh, it looks like this species, but then you're just like, oh no, this is actually a juvenile white shark and not, you know, a short fin mako shark or a poor beagle shark or something like that. So you can run to the end of that as well. And then the third thing I'll actually bring up is within the jaw set of the shark, you have so much variation from like the center part of the teeth, like right at the center of the jaw, and you go work your way laterally, you can see that the teeth change as you go from the center to the lateral part of the jaw. So that's why we have a great example of heterodonty of different tooth shapes all throughout the jaw. So yeah, it's very tricky. Again, my previous advisor, Kenshi Shimada, has tried to reconstruct the jaw sets of extinct sharks, and he's a seasoned pro at it. It can be very difficult and trying at times. So yeah, no cakewalk, that's for sure.
Awesome. And so you use all of these things like teeth to tell you what that shark might look like based on other extant sharks or whatever that is. And that tells you something about the ecology. That's kind of the general goal here, is you understand what they look like and yep. then what that does that tell you about that shark.
Yep. Yep.
So I know you have a recent publication, I think that just came out this year, on the scalloped hammerhead.
Yep.
And is that a similar process that you use for that paper?
Yeah, so that's and that one I was able to just look at the pure morphology of the shark, so just the whole shark and nothing but the shark. And yeah, so no teeth involved with that, luckily, because it's a nice living shark, and we have plenty of specimens here along California, because you know they used to be quite frequent along the Southern California coast, but the fishing and other things have changed things, but they're still present down as you work your way towards Mexico and the Gulf of California. So there were some other scientists that would catch them and whatnot. And they tell us, oh, there's a whole bunch down here. But then I found out the museums have plenty of specimens for me to collect enough data. So yeah, so my question was, what I noticed is once the scalloped hammerhead's an interesting species, because like some shark species, the pregnant females will go to nursery areas, so shallow water, little inlets, and they'll give birth to the pups there, and the pups will be there, so there'll be a bunch of, you know, scalloped hammerhead pups swimming around with each other, and they're protected from larger sharks and predators, because one thing about sharks is they are cannibalistic, and just larger sharks lead smaller sharks. So yeah, it's a lot of fun trying to be a shark in this world, because you just got everything trying to eat you. Everyone thinks they're quite dangerous, but it's hard to even get to the survival point. But yeah, so you got the little juvenile pups swimming around in this nursery area, and you know they're born right around 30 to 40 centimeters total length, and then what will happen is the shark will get bigger, so they'll spend maybe a year in this nursery. And then what happens is, I should set up this way, the shallow water nursery, it's like it's maybe like a meter deep, so that's like 3 feet deep, and then they're moving in a very limited home range, so it's like, you know, very short distances swimming around in circles almost, and you have all kinds of different prey, a lot of benthic prey, benthic fish, you know, maybe some shrimp, crabs and whatnot that they might be able to feed on. But what happens is, as the shark gets bigger, and right around 100 centimeters total length, so as the shark gets bigger, it will shift out of that habitat and go out into what we call the pelagic realm, a lot deeper. So instead of being at 3 feet deep for the first like year of its life, it'll go out to like something like areas that where it's like 1,000 feet deep and whatnot. And what they'll do is they'll travel long distances in the pelagic realm, and they'll start making dives to go capture deep water squid and other fish as they get bigger. So my question was, is the ecological habitat would have different functional demands from being in a shallow water habitat where you got to make very quick maneuvers and you're searching for prey along the bottom, to going out in the pelagic realm where you're making long distance migrations going after prey in the water column, where it's like, so there's no bottom to like trap your prey. You have to chase them down in the open water, which is a lot different.
And that's a lot like the two different fin types you were talking about earlier, those short yes. squat fins versus yep. those long thin fins. I bet that's where we're going.
That's exactly where we're going. So I want to see is, you know, as I just talked about with the teeth over, you know, in this case, it is ontogeny, but the problem that you run into once it tries to get to, once you try to collect museum specimens, and I've been to plenty of museums, it just gets hard to hold larger specimens in these tanks. So the scalloped hammerhead will be born from 30 to 40 centimeters, but as a fully grown adult, it'll be up to about 4 meters total length. So that's right around a little over 12 feet. So trying to get a big tank to hold a 12-foot shark specimen is, the museums are just like, yeah, I don't think so, because that takes up a lot of space. So you do hit a bit of a cap on what you can get to. So I was just at a limit of like right around 130 centimeters total length, give or take. So the point that I found out that was right around is like 95 centimeters. Actually, there's a cool study that showed this one's living. One individual shark traveled about 2,000 miles in a 10-month span. So not bad for a little 95-centimeter shark, you know, pretty good. Yeah, so I traveled a very long distance. I'm just like, in order to do this, you know, just to be a very efficient swimming, moving animal, lower your cost of transport, be able to probably swim a little faster, go after different prey, I would think the shark would have to, I mean, not that the shark just says, I need to change how I look, but I would think way back sometime that it evolved to change, to be shaped differently in the different environments. And what I found out is as the shark got bigger, you know, from when it was born to this length of about 130 centimeters, it did change in a lot of different aspects of its body. So the body shape changes, started to taper off and become more, more of a teardrop shape in a way. It was showing, it was becoming more streamlined, so it would reduce drag and whatnot. And then the fin shapes did change. We saw an increase in aspect ratio, which would probably promote that better cost of transport, lower drag, and help with lift and whatnot. So it was cool to see that the shark actually changed its shape as it shifted its habitat. So I was like, yes, exactly what you said. We got high aspect ratio pectoral fins evolving in the pelagic habitat, or showing up in the pelagic habitat. So it was fascinating to see. It's like, even within the lifestyle, or the, you know, short span of the shark's history, it will change how it looks, or it will change because the ecology has changed. And it's just like, yep, this has been selected for. We need to look this way to be a successful predator in a different habitat. So it's really cool to see that happen with just one species.
Very cool. And so as you're studying the scalloped hammerhead, and you mentioned ontogenetic shifts, and that is the shift in that morphology change as it goes from a little baby shark into a more grown-up shark.
Yep.
And so that's maybe not surprising. I don't think that surprised you, but that's really nice to confirm. Would that be fair to say?
For the scalloped hammerhead, it was, that was the hypothesis and prediction. So I was like, okay, I was right. That's one of those great moments where it's like, okay, I still think Eureka, or not necessarily Eureka is the best moment, but there's a quote that says, ha, that's funny. It's like, you actually are wrong and you find something even cooler and more interesting, which did happen to me before. It was cool to see. Yep, that was the idea, that the shark changes its habitat. It's probably going to change as it gets older, it gets bigger, and it looks like, you know, at this point, it seems to be confirmed and supported that it does go through that. But you don't see that pattern with every shark species. Some just purely, they just get bigger. Like, they don't change in shape. It's just the shark just gets bigger. Everything grows at the same rate. It's like the fin just gets bigger. It's still the same shape as it was before once it was a baby. But in this case, the scalloped hammerhead is like, no, the fin shape definitely changed as it got older. So it's an interesting pattern that I'm probably going to investigate further throughout my shark studies. Is you're starting to see a bit of a pattern. It tends to be the larger shark species that show the allometry and the change, autogenetic change. But the smaller, what we regard as like smaller species, like, yes, they're a smaller shark, but they're born small and then they'll get to a certain length. They tend to stay the same shape overall, but they just get bigger in size, if that makes sense.
And that has to do with maybe where the change in the habitat from, maybe those smaller sharks are born and stay within a habitat that's not quite as big as the open ocean, and they're not moving around as much.
That's exactly it. Yeah. So there's a cool, I mean, it's like, it does raise some questions because there's a species. So the black tip shark, which is found, you'll find it. There's some great drone videos, and for the lovely bathers and swimmers in what county is it? New Smyrna Beach over there on the east coast of Florida, which is near Daytona. Don't go to that beach if you don't want to get bit by a shark on the foot, because it's called the shark bite capital of the world. Because what happens is a lot of black tip shark species will be swimming through there, and they'll bump into a swimmer and they'll just bite their foot and you get a little shark bite. So what we found out is, those species, they go through what we call isometry, exactly what he says. They stick with that same habitat all throughout their life. So they're born along the coast and they just stay along the coast. And you do see some segregations, like, the smaller ones will tend to cluster with each other, then the larger ones will cluster with each other, but they don't really shift their habitat at all. They're just a nice coastal species and they'll move up and down the coast and that's it. So it does make sense. It's like they're born in the same habitat and they stay there all throughout their life. Why would the functional demands change? So, exactly. Great point. When you change the habitat, that seems to be the driver of, like, oh, yeah, you probably you're going to have to change how you look because you're in a different area. But these species, same spot, same place, no need, just get bigger, faster. But for the most part, you've been there, you know what to do. It's just going to be the same for you.
And so when we think of the research that you're doing on the big picture here, your mm-hmm. body forms and changes over these really long periods of time, what importance does this have to either the shark research community or maybe just the folks that study body morphology in general? What is the big important takeaway here?
Yeah, I mean, so I've always been, that's a question that will come up, you know, during an oral exam. They're asking, like, why, what is the importance to all this? And it's still a question that, you know, I don't say it keeps me up at night, but it's just like, well, what is going on here? Because I make the case for sharks being the coolest ones out there because they've just been around for such a long time. You're just like, they've seen a lot. I mean, they have that. I give them like my analogy for what sharks are is they're like a heavyweight boxer and that they just keep taking these punches round after round. And sometimes they'll get knocked down and then they'll just come right back because in the 400 million year history that they've been around, there's been plenty of mass extinctions. There's been a lot more competition for them. Things have changed on the earth, but yet this lineage has continued to survive and thrive. Although of course the greatest threat the sharks have ever faced is occurring right now. And it happens to be these individuals who are on two legs and they like to throw their hooks in the water and bring them up out of the water. But it's amazing that a terrestrial species can cause so much damage to an aquatic species, but that's a whole shark conservation debate. So not to go off too far off topic, but so the question is, because when we do get some of these specimens that are dated back hundreds of millions of years, we can see what did they look like way back when? Because one of the questions we all raise is like, that it appears sharks are slower to evolve, at least when you look at their molecular DNA information compared to like mammals. It's trying to understand the DNA of sharks is also a lot of fun. Looking at their evolution, they move at it's a lot slower rates. So we do wonder is like, what happened? Did they just get to certain body forms and shapes? And then has that design worked for such a long time? It's like, no matter what's happened on the earth, like, okay, there was climatic cooling, you know, maybe there's a change in prey, or maybe there's another predator that showed up and this competition's going on, the environment's changing, but the shark body design is good for like any situations. Like it's good for, you know, it's good for those high speed chases. It's good for the quick maneuvers. So despite that things have changed, does it show that, you know, is there an optimal, I don't want to say like design, but it's like when you have so much evolutionary history, you're probably going to arrive to these final endpoints. It's like, no, this is, nothing's perfect because things are always changing with, you know, certain minute things happening in the environment, but they get to this optimal area where it's like, this is working well for them. And since you've kind of reached a stasis, it's like, okay, we're here. And like, this is working. And you know, that's the same constant prey. But then even once a radical change happens, it's like, okay, we got to make a shift. It still works for that shift. So it raises the questions like, do we have the same body form throughout this long evolutionary history? It's just worked. It's like this optimal design. Because sometimes, and I go back to what Shimada told me, is like, did they just get lucky? It's like, did the genes just give them like this lucky thing? It's like, all right, producing teeth constantly all throughout their lifetime, just producing, larger baby sharks. So instead of like most species, which will produce like 1,000 offspring, but they're very small, they'll get picked off. They produce larger babies in this case compared to other fish species. They're already like ample predators. So it's like, did everything just work for them? Did everything just fall in line for the lineage of sharks? Be like, okay, all these traits work well. And then one of those questions is, did the body design just work out well? But again, there's a lot of variation in body design throughout the shark, phylogeny. So again, going back to the original questions, big pictures, how does that shape of the shark work throughout its long evolutionary history? Has it changed because of the environment, or is it just the optimal design that's been efficient for a very long time? And that's something I continue to think about and toll over for the last, it's been on my mind the last 5 years since I started this venture. I'm trying to get those answers and be like, okay, hey, this makes the most sense. But whether that happens in the next year or two once I try to defend my dissertation, or if it takes another 10 to 15 years of pure shark research of looking at all these different aspects, mm-hmm. then I'll have the answer. I don't know, but that's the long road that I'm on, and it's a fun journey.
Awesome. And do you think, I don't think there's an answer to this question, but I got to ask it. Mm-hmm. What would it take for the sharks to survive and have just a radical body change? Do you think that's even likely a remote possibility in the probabilities of our future timeline?
In our future timeline, so will you and I live to see that? Probably not. I would say no, because again, them being very slow to evolve. I am curious because, you know, there are some very, okay, so the great example we have is the hammerhead lineage. So there's about, I think we're at eight or nine species, I forget, because then there's this Carolina hammerhead that looks identical to the lovely scalloped hammerhead that I studied. So and that gets tricky because you have to use DNA to be like, oh, it looks identical, but it's DNA different. But yeah, so that's going down the rabbit hole. So what's interesting is with the hammerhead lineage. So if you go to like what we call like the earliest representative of hammerheads of the extant ones, it's called the winghead shark. And it actually has the largest head. So it's got the longest cephalofoil out of all the species. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is the most recently evolved species of hammerhead is called the bonnethead. Sorry, I was thinking of scalloped bonnethead. It's actually the bonnethead shark. But the bonnethead has the smallest cephalofoil out of all the species. So we're starting to think it's like, did they just randomly get the hammer by some weird mutation, and then now that they're just actually trying to get rid of it, as you know, as they continue to evolve, it's like, oh, it popped up and now it seems to be getting smaller throughout the hammerhead evolution, which is quite extraordinary. So you do wonder, are there just some oddball characters that popped up and then, you know, it worked? Because I mean, the hammerheads are still kicking, still swimming, you know, they're doing just fine. And there's a radical species, I don't know if you've heard of it, it's called Helicorpion. And it's so it you know, the body design, again, we do speculate, but it's jaw set. It's the weirdest looking thing, you know, for anybody who's going to be listening to this, it's like you can Google an image of a rendition. I mean, we do have the fossils look at, but it's got like it looks like a saw within the mouth of the sharks. And it's very creepy and weird looking. So you do get some oddball characters. And so
last year we did have Dr. Tapanilla, who studies those, on here as an interviewer. So if the listeners want to go back and listen to that episode, we have links to some of those pictures of exactly what you're talking about, where it's just, boy, is that a shark?
you really do scratch your head. It's just, it's like, so how did this happen? It's like, okay, it's a random thing. So to get, you know, a radical design, I don't know from what we've seen, because we do have a nice diversity now, and you see again slender body sharks, you got some, you know, like the goblin shark, which looks creepy, it's got like a slingshot jaw, and then again you got giant filter feeding sharks like the whale shark, megamouth, and the basking shark. So those are like some oddballs there. So we have our extremes for shark body shapes, and then we have those there in the middle. So are we going to see anything outside that range? I don't know. If we did, though, that would be fascinating. But again, I think that'd be long after we're gone, because it'd probably take a while to get there, unless some crazy mutation or there's, you know, it's like, okay, but that could be a deformity and whatnot. So will we ever see that? Probably not. Would I love to see that? Of course. It'd be like the greatest thing ever, but I don't think we will.
Cool. Any last minute thoughts you want to share with the listeners?
At this point, no. I would just say sharks are cool. Everybody should study sharks. Go to a museum or aquarium and look at, you know, fossil shark teeth, or go see a living shark. Or, you know, the thing that I've learned since I started studying sharks, you know, I can read about them all I want. And then coming from the Midwest, you know, I can go to the aquarium and see them, you know, for a couple hours. But seeing them in the wild in their natural habitat, you just gain so much insight. You just see, what is the shark actually doing? You know, it's like you get these concepts and you watch Shark Week, and when I was like, oh, they're just, you know, mindless predators. And even you watch Jaws and all that, you're just like, oh, it's, you know, they're not like that. You just seeing them in the natural habitat, you just understand them so much more. And then it gives you insights as a biologist, like, all right, this is what the shark's doing on a daily basis. This is how it's surviving in the environment. So for being a shark person, just even any biologist in general, seeing your animal or your, you know, species in its natural environment, in normal conditions, it gives you a lot of insight and appreciation of what you're actually studying. So just reading text on a paper all the time, it's like, oh, it did this in this experiment. So yeah, that's one thing that I've learned, is seeing it in its natural habitat is a really cool thing.
Excellent. And so for all the listeners out there, if you're interested to learn more, about, I don't, do you just want Phil the shark researcher?
Sure, that's perfect.
The shark researcher. I'm going to link a couple of the papers that I have, his most recent paper from 2022 on the scalped hammerhead. Do you have any social media that the listeners could go see?
I do not have any social media. I tend to, yeah, it was my friends have urged me and they got me to go on. The only thing that I was able to, or they were able to urge me to go on was Snapchat a couple of years ago so I can keep in touch with them once I moved out here to California. And I do frequently send them shark videos and stingray things. And yes, just yesterday, you can ask, they found out as I was fishing yesterday, we caught a bat ray. And unfortunately, the bat ray was not very, I mean, it's never happy once it has a hook in its mouth. And, you know, I'm trying to take the hook out of its mouth and then send it back on its merry way into the ocean. So, but once you're taking the hook out of its mouth, it got a little agitated. It was trying to bite my finger and it left a little mark on there. So, it wasn't happy, but ultimately no damage really done to the shark, slight hole in its mouth, but we tossed it back into the pier and it swam off swimmingly and had a good day, but wasn't very happy once they had a hook in its mouth. So you learn that, but social media, no, I tend to stay low profile. I do have something called a ResearchGate profile though, which is free for everybody to look up. So that has all my posted research and has any updates that I'll provide. So if you're curious about the shark research, I suggest looking at my ResearchGate profile.
Awesome. Great. So we'll have a link to that paper and then also your ResearchGate in the show notes. So fans can go read more of your stuff if they want to. And then we have one more super surprise guest. This is his first podcast appearance. Awesome. And so it's my nephew, Kenny, has a couple questions he would love to ask you, the professional, about what you do. And so I am going to switch seats with him briefly. And Kenny, just sit down here, make sure you talk loud and clear and introduce yourself to the listeners and to Phil and ask the questions that you have and I'll be right over here.
This isn't my first time being on the internet though.
Oh, not on the internet. All right.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm Kenny.
Yep. So just take a deep breath and just say, talk really loud and introduce yourself. You're doing great.
Sorry.
That's okay. You can take your time. So you can look at me if it's more comfortable and you can tell me who you are. That'd be fine.
Sorry, I'm just...
That's all right. Phil's a pretty nice guy. He's working on his PhD and I bet he's been around lots of different kids of all ages. And The best questions are questions from non-professionals. That's what I think anyway. I think those are the most fun to get. So we're very excited to hear the questions that you have for us.
Oh, well, here's a really big question for you. Why are you interested in specifically the Megalodon and not any other shark?
That's a great question, Kenny. Yeah. So, well, you got to think that the Megalodon was the biggest and arguably the baddest shark to ever live. So everyone just say, you know, it's like, why is everybody like the T-Rex? You know, it was the biggest dinosaur around, the Megalodon, biggest shark around. And it's really mysterious because it was around for a long time and then it just disappeared all of a sudden. We're just like, why did it disappear? It seemed like a cool shark, a cool predator that was really big and bad. It was able to take out everybody else that it competed with, but yet it just mysteriously disappeared. So it's a real cool mystery. And it's also just the biggest and baddest shark that ever lived. So you're just like, okay, I want to study this one. That's definitely the one I want to focus on. So yeah, just big, bad shark. I'm curious what happened with its entire life. So yeah, that's the reason why.
Okay. What gave you the idea to study field guide images of the Megalodon and other sharks of that same species?
Yeah, so it gets tricky because when you're trying to look at all the shark species in the world, it's hard to get that information of just pure pictures because some of them are found in like, okay, you got to go to Australia or go to Indonesia. So you'd have to like travel and you'd have to try to find that shark species, and that costs a lot of money and takes a lot of time to do. And sometimes asking those people to find the pictures from way back when, it's very hard. So we want to do things quickly. Well, not quickly, but we want to have like a uniform pattern where it's just like, oh, everything's in one nice picture. So it's like a nice big picture book. Everything's right there. And the field guide has every drawing of every shark species. So it's like all in one spot. I'm just like, okay, I don't have to go asking people for this instead. Everyone has it in one spot and location. It's like I can just open up any page on the book and like, oh, there's that shark species. There's the drawing I need. It gives me all the information I need. So it's very helpful because it's like, hey, even if I don't know what the shark looks like, say you hear a species name, you can open up the book and be like, oh, this is what it looks like. This is its color pattern. This is how big it gets. So it's very useful because it's just a nice shark book for everybody, including the non-scientists and the scientists to use. It's very helpful.
What is your day-to-day life in the field of studying sharks?
Yeah, that's a fun question. So the best days are once I get to go to the field actually and like swatch the sharks with like drones and stuff and see them swimming around and record information on that. So that's a lot of fun once you actually get to see the species. So that'll happen, you know, a couple times a month once I get to go and actually see them. For the most part, as what other scientists will tell you, is we sit at our computers a lot and just looking at all the information we recorded, and we have to analyze it using computer programs. So it can be fun because unlike a lot of us who like to sit at our computer and watch YouTube videos and do other things where we could just relax, you're glued to your screen, typing things out constantly, looking at numbers, and it makes your brain almost be on fire sometimes because you're trying to figure out, all right, what's happening, and you have to make your computer run for a couple hours to analyze this data set. So for the most part, I am sitting at my computer just analyzing my data, looking at all these numbers on a screen. But the cool days are once I actually get to go out and see sharks in the wild and see them swimming, doing their thing, and recording, taking video of them, and taking pictures of them, or going to a museum and looking at the preserved specimens as well.
Okay, this is my final question because I'm actually really interested in this field. What would be a good school to go to for this field of science?
So for studying sharks, you have a lot of options out there, but where are you going to find sharks? That's the question I ask. You're going to find them in the ocean. So I recommend most of the schools that are, you know, coastal schools or near the water, those tend to be your best schools because you can get close to the sharks and actually see them in the wild. So Florida has a lot of shark schools out there, they have schools that have shark programs. So the University of Miami at Florida has a huge shark program out there. Florida International University has another shark program as well. Here in California, we have California State University Long Beach, which has the shark lab. So we have those options. And then up in Stanford, there's Marine Biological Station that'll look at the sharks up there as well. So I would recommend any university that's near the water usually has a marine biology or shark program. And some have really big, a high profile, a lot of money shark programs that get their researchers up close and personal and produce great studies and whatnot. So those are the ones that jump out in my mind.
So you said you swabbed sharks with drones?
Swabbed them. Well, we spied on them. Spied. So yeah, we kind of just, so the sharks are swimming along. Yeah, no, that's totally okay. So yeah, that's the great thing about drones. Because if you've ever seen a drone before, they're pretty small and then they're very quiet. So what's cool is we'll launch it and then we'll just fly it right above the shark and the shark doesn't know what's going on. So what we find out is like when a diver goes in the water with the shark or if we're on a boat, that tends to change its behavior. So we're like, is that its natural behavior? But when you're flying a drone above the shark doesn't know the drone's there. So it's just going to continue to do its daily thing, like it's walking in the park or something like that. In this case, it's just swimming along. But we can also see some really cool things where it's like, oh, it sees a stingray that wants to chase after, or it sees another bigger shark and wants to swim away from that bigger shark. So yeah, the drones give you a lot of cool information. And yes, I would argue we spy on them because they don't know that we're looking at them and watching them doing their thing. So yeah, it's a lot of fun because you can see how they're behaving and what they're doing on a daily basis.
Okay, those are all of my questions.
All right, thank you so much for those. Those are a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to wrap this up. Kenny, thank you so much for joining us. Phil, thank you as well. I guess if listeners have any other questions, they can go and check out your ResearchGate profile anytime. And if you come up with any new and fascinating research, I hope you reach out to us again because we would love to hear about it.
Absolutely, yes. If anything, the next big stuff that seems to be on the horizon, I'm working at right now, I will be happy to reach out and let you guys know because it'll be a pretty cool project. So yeah, I will definitely be in touch.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you guys. Thank you very much.
Well, all right. Thanks, Doc. Thanks, Phil. So that's it. You've listened to a bunch of fish nerds when you should have been fishing. Big thanks to everybody for tuning in. We appreciate you. Thanks to Kristen, my wife, for letting me make this podcast now for more than 10 years. Thanks to, our music guy, Wally Pleasant, for making the music for this pod. I am so out of practice. And, of course, thanks, everybody. All right, let's get out of here. Until next time, follow the code of the fish nerds. Spawn early and often. Never trust a free lunch with strings attached and swim against the current every chance you get. Whether you're fly fishing, kicking the buttons right. Getting those ankles wet or deep in the ocean casting nets. Fish nerds. Fish nerds. Fish nerds. It's a podcast. Just for the halibut. Fried in a basket or broiled in a pan. Eat it raw like you're in Siam. Fish nerds. Fish nerds.